least you can't trust the weather, man.
Weather forecasters are a maligned group. Loved when the weather's good, objects of scorn when they blow a forecast. How do you know that the person who creates your weather forecasts knows what he or she is doing? That's our main topic during this week's edition of Jet Streaming. Welcome to Jet Streaming from Minnesota Public Radio. I love this music that we play.
Great music.
Oh.
Where'd you find that? That's good.
In the archives.
Love it.
At Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Kathy Werzer, along with my cohorts, Mark Seeley, climatologist and meteorologist with the University of Minnesota, and Minnesota Public Radio meteorologist Paul Huttner. Good to see you guys again.
Good to see you, Kathy.
Well, Paul, when I watch you on TV, one of your many roles, I notice a little seal from the American Meteorological Society in the corner of the screen, which is the same story for a lot of TV meteorologists.
Yes.
Is that a big deal?
You know, I think it is, and a lot of people in the profession think it is. You know, we've known for years that as weather folks, meteorologists, we're all certifiable, right?
Yes.
Well, we've been certified, and now we're going to get recertified. There's a whole push, a whole program right now to update the seal, if you will, to certified broadcast meteorologist. And we think it's important because we think the public is better served by having people that are qualified and know what they're doing out there and are able to explain a very complex science to a wide variety of people. So that's one of the reasons we do this.
Is recertification tough?
I haven't taken the test yet. I'm in the process right now of studying for it. And with moving and whatnot, I'm going to do it later this summer. So I guess I'll tell you in about 3 months.
Well, we're going to find a little bit more here from Kelly Savoy. Kelly is with the American Meteorological Society. She's the manager of marketing and special programs. Kelly, thanks for joining us.
Sure.
Well, tell me a little bit about this certification program. Why was it initiated?
Well, we actually decided to come up with a new certification program called the Certified Broadcast Meteorologist Program. Meteorology has become increasingly technical over the past two decades, and the Society felt that there should be a new certification that raised the bar on educational background and expertise. And the CBM does that, and it represents a new standard of excellence in broadcast meteorology. This is not to imply that those with the AMS seal are not well qualified, but to obtain a CBM, one must be even better qualified.
Kelly, how many CBMs so far, how many current AMS seal holders are there, and how is that process going?
Well, currently there are over 1,600 seal holders. Right now we have 214 CBMs that have been awarded since 2005, and that represents about 19% of our seal holders have upgraded to the CBM. And you were mentioning something about recertification, which is a little different. We do have a professional development program that we started around the same time as the CBM, where both CBMs and seal holders have to go through a professional development program. So it's not really recertification. It's more like an upgrade to the current seal certification. So once a seal holder takes the CBM exam and passes it, then it will replace their seal.
Say, Kelly, Mark Seeley here. I wondered, are you out in front of the pack in terms of this process? For example, having lived and worked in the UK, I'm aware that the BBC meteorologists are trained by the UK Met Office and are not allowed, if you will, to broadcast on the airwaves until they've achieved a certain level of training. I suspect there's similar programs in Canada and Australia and some of the other countries as well. Do you know if this certification program is as rigorous or perhaps more than theirs?
I'm not completely familiar with some of the other countries' certification programs. I was aware that they do have some type of certifications, but it's more, if I believe, it's more job-related, where it's part of like a weather service type thing where someone from the UK receives a certification and that's part of their position. I think this is a little different because it's an outside type program where we're certifying individuals who are working at different television stations and corporations even throughout the U.S. So I think it's a little different, although I'm not really familiar with exactly how Canada and the UK have their certifications.
Kelly, is this to cut down on, say, the cute weather forecaster that has no background but looks good on screen?
Well, we're hoping that with the certification programs that we offer, individuals will, well, first of all, they'll have to have an educational background in order to even be eligible to apply. For the CBM, they need to have a degree in meteorology or higher than a BS or an MS. And then they also have to have some type of background in meteorology. So somebody who doesn't know how to do their own forecast or isn't who doesn't have a background, an educational background in meteorology, they're not even going to be able to get the certification. So it's definitely going to be a difference.
Kelly, you know, interesting the business that we work in. News directors are the people that hire people for on air. And of course, you don't have control over those people. We don't have control over news directors. What's it like at AMS realizing the state of the industry that we can put out all the seals we want and get qualified people in there, but news directors still make that choice and they don't always choose to hire somebody with a seal? What does AMS think about that? And what do you guys do about that at the professional level?
Well, we're really trying to promote our programs, and we also have a new initiative called the Station Scientist Program, where we're trying to get our seal holders and CBMs information on different areas of the science, you know, such as watersheds and the indexes and all that kind of stuff. So we're really trying to push it, and I do think what we're headed in the right direction, because I have been getting calls from news directors inquiring about what the requirements are for the seal and the CBM, and also asking us, you know, what their meteorologists need to do to get that. I've had just recently, a couple of weeks ago, I had a news director in Florida set up a taped interview with me here at the AMS to talk about the CBM so that it could present it at a regional news directors meeting. So I know that the word is getting out, and I think it's going to be a slow process, but I think we're going to see things improve within the next few years in terms of news directors.
It seems, Kelly, that this could do nothing but strengthen the relationship between broadcast meteorologists and the National Weather Service in terms of putting them on the same page and using the technology as well as getting the appropriate messages out in a timely manner. Do you sense that is happening across the country?
I can't really say. I mean, the AMS does come up with statements often on, you know, climate change and the use of radar and how you should use it appropriately with time stamping and things such as that. So, you know, I think things are starting to change, although I don't really get a sense for it, you know, specifically on that topic. So I'm not really sure.
This is maybe a loaded question here with a TV meteorologist sitting just not more than 2 feet away from me here, Kelly. But what do you think of the quality of forecasting when it comes to broadcast meteorologists?
Well, that's a tough question because there are so many broadcast meteorologists in so many stations throughout the country. And, you know, occasionally we will get complaints from viewers. Usually they're a little silly about somebody blowing a forecast, and you know the person has the AMS seal, and we should, you know, take away their certification for it. But overall, I you know, I'm not an authority on that. I can't really tell you, you know, how well certain stations are doing with the forecasting.
Well, what makes a good forecaster? That's interesting because, you know, it's a very complicated science. First of all, it's broadcast meteorology. So you have to have the broadcasting part of it. You have to be able to explain
exactly that
complicated science to the general public. And good forecasting, you know, it's a mix. I've worked with people from all different backgrounds in forecasting. I've worked with people from the Air Force who don't have degrees, who are some of the best forecasters I've ever worked with. And I've worked with people who have master's degrees in meteorology that, quite frankly, can't forecast their way out of a paper bag. It's not because of just theory. It's forecasting is a decision-making process. It's about looking at 100 variables, finding out which 10 are the most important, and then really which 2 or 3 are going to affect the weather forecast for that day. So it's complicated stuff. And Kelly does a good job in the AMS of dealing with people from a lot of different backgrounds and trying to get them this certification so that the public knows that they have somebody they can trust. And, you know, do we blow the forecast? Yes. Remember, weather forecasting, it's not a perfect science. I always do the analogy of an architect. He has a steel I-beam. He knows exactly how much it weighs, what the length is, what the load will support. As meteorologists, we only have data from a fraction of the atmosphere. And the computer models have to put that data together. And sometimes, in fact, most of the time, they're off by some degree of error. And the art of forecasting is trying to figure out where they're off and how we can improve on that.
Of course, Paul is never wrong. We want you to know that.
Well, it is really difficult. I'm from New England, so believe me, I wait until a day before to check the weather to find out what it's really going to be.
Well, Kelly, I appreciate you joining us here. Thank you so much.
Sure.
We've been talking to Kelly Savoy with the AMS.
No matter what you did, but walk on your tiptoes, don't tie no bows, better stay away from those that care out of fire hose. Keep a clean nose, wash the clean clothes, you don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows.
Well, broadcast meteorologists now have at their disposal some pretty high-powered radar equipment. Actually, radar is a key tool for any forecaster. And we thought as we head into the summer storm season that it might be fun for listeners to get a primer on properly deciphering the weather radars you can now find on the Internet. So, Mark and Paul, I'm going to try to log on here. I have here in front of me, I was just noticing that this is going to be a day ripe for severe weather, I think, later this afternoon. But since we're talking here at a different hour of the day, I see that in Des Moines, at least in the Des Moines, Fort Dodge, Iowa area, there are some storms brewing right now. So let's just talk a little bit about how folks can read a weather radar, okay?
Sure.
Okay, I'm logged on here to the National Weather Service radar out of Des Moines. And when you two first look at a radar, there's a composite and a base image reflectivity. What do you use normally?
I'll usually look at the base reflectivity. That is the lowest angle that the radar beam shoots out at. And really, it's closest to the ground, and it's usually a good indicator of, kind of visually what people can expect in terms of the brighter the colors, the heavier the rain or the snow, the precipitation. Base reflectivity is usually, when a radar beam goes out from the antenna, it's usually shot out at a half degree above the horizon. And that's the angle normally that you're going to see when you're looking at base reflectivity.
Okay.
I think that's generally true, Paul, for most meteorologists that I know. Their first look is at the base reflectivity. And then after that, they might look at the composite, the multiple angle scans that are coming in. But the other thing that's very important, I think, for listeners to appreciate is we get intensity level is embedded in the return signal, so you can infer intensity level of the precipitation. But many people that I know that are weather geeks and they commonly look at the weather radar on their computers are also looking for trajectories. They're looking for motion. And so they like to look at the radar display in animated mode in order to determine which direction are the heavier cells moving, or are some developing where there weren't any before? And so it also infers trajectory characteristics that I think a lot of people are infatuated with.
So here, Paul Huttner and Mark, as we're watching this cell just around Fort Dodge, Iowa here, it looks like it is just kind of moving up, maybe north-northeast?
Yeah, and you can infer that, like Mark said, from the animated radars that we look at all the time. There are many, many tools that the seasoned meteorologist will look at in addition to just the general direction of movement and the intensity of storms or rainfall. There's a whole variety of algorithms that the Doppler radar puts out. Doppler radar is sending out these pulses at an incredibly fast rate, and it can see the movement of storms, and beyond that, it can see relative wind movements within the storm. So basically how it works is it'll show raindrops that are moving away from the radar and toward the radar, and then it will give the speed of those. So you can infer some wind velocities, for example, damaging winds and thunderstorms. And you can also see rotation, and that's what we look for in the area called the mesocyclone, the wall cloud area that can produce tornadoes. So when tornado warnings are issued, they'll be issued a couple of different ways. They may be issued by a spotter on the ground who's actually seen a funnel or a tornado on the ground, or they may be issued by Doppler radar. If they see that, what we call TVS, tornado vortex signature, that swirling, that spinning, that couplet of air that's moving in a circular fashion, they will issue a tornado warning for that as well.
Would you then, if you're watching radar here, would it be the reddest, most intense then area of the radar that you might want to be looking at?
If you're looking at velocity data, which is the other part of the data, what we call the Doppler part of the data, you're looking for red and green right next to each other, what we call a couplet. That's a tornado vortex signature. And if you see those two in a certain part of the thunderstorm, you can infer that they're could be a circulation that could produce a tornado there. There's all kinds of other things we look at. Storm geometry. There are certain signatures, the hook echo. Maybe folks have heard about that before. Looks like a fish hook backwards. That's something that we look for as well to infer what might be a tornadic thunderstorm.
You know, go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, I was just going to add one other thing since we're talking about the most severe situation where the Doppler radar is being used. Under those situations, I might emphasize, Kathy, it's extremely important for the radar operator, the person assigned to the display, to keep his or her full attention on the display, because changes in the display that occur over the course of seconds and minutes can be extremely critical, just for the reasons that Paul mentioned in terms of detecting those rotational effects in the storm.
You know, again, we're watching a Des Moines, Iowa radar here, the National Weather Service out of Des Moines, and under velocity here, I'm just clicking on the base under velocity here, and I am seeing, and I don't know if this is correct or not, but I am seeing some red and green together. Now, but this looks like this could be just kind of garden variety wind and rain.
I'm not seeing what you're seeing on my display, but there is a certain signature that you look for, and as a wind passes over the radar site, it will go from red to green, because if you have an environmental wind that's, say, out of the south, it will change colors once that passes the axis of the radar site. Part of this is don't try this at home, honestly.
Right.
We
yes.
go to seminars and what we call COMET courses on radar, on how to read and interpret the radar, and it takes a long time. The general person can understand base reflectivity and go through the color displays that are on the title bar or the key on the side there, and it goes up in dBz, decibels, this algorithm that calculates the density of raindrops per meter of air. And the higher the dBz, the heavier, generally, the rainfall that you're looking at.
By the way, any online radar that you two really like? Do you usually mostly go off the National Weather Service radars?
Well, mostly NOAA.gov for me.
Okay.
Yes.
Right.
I like, there's a great program from College of DuPage that has a bunch of different radar images that you can look at. And there are others out there. And some of them have the advanced radar parameters that you can look at as well.
Do you trust the TV stations' weather sites online?
Usually. Although looking, and it's not because the radars aren't right, it's because sometimes with software and going through the IT department and all that, things aren't always updated. So we blame it on the IT guys, right?
Very good. Okay. Good lesson here. Thank you so much. And thanks, by the way, to everyone for listening to Jet Streaming. We even have a new form for folks to send us questions. And we do have one from a listener, which fits with our discussion. Here it is. What is meant by the ZR relationship that meteorologists speak of in estimating total rainfall from radar signals?
That simply stated is just what Paul was referring to. The code displayed, the code bar displayed on the radar will give a level of dBz, the decibel, in the return signal, the power of the return signal in the backscatter. And that's directly related to the intensity of the rainfall, that is the rainfall rate, so many inches per hour or millimeters per hour. Generally, the higher the number, the more intense the rain. These relationships, ZR relationships, are algorithms that really need to be tuned for the type of cloud, the type of system. So there's one form of ZR relationship that is tailored to the reading the rainfall rate in a stratiform layered cloud deck. In fact, there's multiple versions of that. Then there's the deep convective form, which is the one we're seeing over Des Moines, Iowa today, which is scanning and determining a rainfall rate based on a ZR relationship that is appropriate for convective storm systems. There's a variety of these, and it's important that each National Weather Service office have theirs tuned, and they change these quite frequently, Kathy, especially this time of year in the spring. They may change these around a little bit to fine-tune so that they get a decent estimate of the rainfall rate by looking at the radar display.
And one of the challenges that they've had with these ZR rates is estimating radar estimated rainfall. They tend to read hot. They tend to read high. So if you get a storm that's putting down an inch and a half of rain, sometimes they can be high on the order of 50%.
Mm.
So versus what you're actually seeing at the ground in terms of measured liquid precipitation. So they are tweaking them, they are working with them, and they are really valuable in terms of helping us. But like many things in meteorology, we have to use a little bit of art with the science as well.
Well, as we're talking about websites, it's my turn, isn't it, this week?
It is.
All right. The website of the week. I love this one. It's the National Center for Atmospheric Research's real-time weather data website.
Oh, yeah.
It's very cool. You can view satellite images, NextRad Doppler radar from around the country, surface conditions near you. And then, with all that info, you can become your own weather forecaster using some cool guidance tools provided on the website. I think you'll like it. One of my favorites, it's at rap.ucar.edu/weather.
Boy, you let the cat out of the bag on that one, Kathy. We're going to have people that are going to be staring at that one all day long now.
That's bookmarked on my page,
no,
I can tell you that.
My boss knows what I've been doing after I get off the air, clicking around and, you know. Well, this was fun. Thank you.
Thank you,
yes,
Kathy.
Very
good. It was
good.
A good lesson on the radar, and I hope you pass your recertification test.
You know, I've taken the practice test, and okay. I passed with flying colors.
Of course
so,
you would.
We'll give it a shot here in the next couple of months. Let you know how it comes out.
I hope so. Lots of good information. Thanks, gentlemen.
Thanks,
Kathy.
If you want to contact us, go to minnesotapublicradio.org. In the podcast section, click on Jet Streaming, and there you'll find a link to send us questions or comments. That's minnesotapublicradio.org. For Mark Seeley and Paul Huttner, I'm Kathy Werzer with help from producer extraordinaire Larissa Anderson. Thanks for listening to Jet Streaming, and remember to keep your eye on the sky. We'll be back next week.
Yeah, I know. Things are tough all over. When the thunderstorms start increasing over the southeast and south central portions of my apartment, I get upset. And a line of thunderstorms was developing in the early morning hours ahead of a slow-moving cold front. Cold-blooded. With tornadoes.